What's good, y'all? This is Breeze Brewing from the Mighty Juggernauts. And make sure you subscribe and download the podcast. Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Hip-hop journalism on the highest level.
Yeah, what's up? It's your boy Joel Ortiz, and I want everybody to make sure that they subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Yo, Tim, I hope all is well. You my guy. I know these interviews are not interviews, they're actually conversations, and I appreciate them all. Yeah.
Root up the problem that had been here for years. Seen them before, they bring people to tears. Eradicate the hate, wait, supremacy at stake, fate.
Producer, MC, curator, composer, journalist, historian. My next guest wears many hats. His group, Get Open, has released their latest album, Front and Center. He's Sibba Jibba, and I want to welcome him to Library Rap, hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Thank you so much for being here, man. I really appreciate it.
Peace, man. Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask you about your journey, you know, from France to the States. But I'm going to weirdly ask you about, I started off by asking you about Get Open's latest album, Front and Center. You know, there's the record on the album, Where I'm From, which is also a title of one of my favorite Jay-Z tracks. You know, same title, Where I'm From.
Mm-hmm.
Both tracks are, I think, equally great tracks. And how much, if at all, and maybe there wasn't anything even considering at the time, but how much of at all was maybe an ode to the Jay-Z track? And how did you guys come up with this record, and why did you decide to kind of do a record Where I'm From?
Well, that record actually, and it's funny you asked about Jay-Z, because people in the past have asked that question about the name of the group, because he had that song with Uptown Flavor, right? Can I Get Open?
Right.
So that's been asked in the past. No, there was no real, there was no influence from Jay-Z or even as a title. That came about really because this album that we put out, we'd been working on it for like 4 years, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first song we did, which Can You Resist, which totally changed when Daddy-O came on board. It was a whole other song.
Right.
We recorded that like in 2017, 2018. So Where I'm From came out later than that. And it was really just a song that we wanted to have on the record, just to like kind of situate where all the members of the group were from, you know, knowing I'm originally from France. So my whole vision of New York City and my whole, I guess, the way I see things is totally different than the two other members who are from the Bronx and from Harlem.
Right.
You know, I'm not born here. I came here as very young, but so I have a whole other vision. And the filmmaker, Pascal Tissot, he's actually a filmmaker. He really rarely does videos, but he really likes our work. So he took it upon himself and said, you know what? I want to make this video with you guys. So he really had the vision as far as the visuals, you know, like what he wanted to kind of include, and, you know, didn't want to be too cliche, because this kind of video and song has been done before. You know, we're aware of that.
I mean, I think one lyric that stands out, I'm not going to quote it perfectly, but I think it's you who say, you know, Lottie, you talk about Lottie Dottie and having kind of a big impact on you. And like you joke, I think more in jest, but jokingly saying like you lost your French accent because of it, right? Can you take me back to growing up? I know you came here to the States when you're young, but growing up in France, and what was it about this particular record that, you know, Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick, obviously two great storytellers, that stood out to you and had that impact on you?
Well, I mean, that song, because when I wrote the song, I was thinking about what's the first song that I learned, because as kids, right, we learn lyrics from songs, whatever song it is. And then you go back to school and you try to, you know, be a big shot. And like, I know the song better than you, right?
Right.
So that was that kind of thing. But, you know, you got to rewind and think about, this is a young kid who's about 12, 13 years old. Has been to the States before, because my father's from New York, right? That's where my connection is. So I've been here before. I've never really lived here, but I've been back and forth, you know. So my English is not the best, you know, spitting that many words in a row for me was a major challenge. But then, you know, it was the kids on the street that I met in Lower East Side in Manhattan, because that's really where I grew up, that pushed me. And they were, you know, learning themselves. And I remember that being kind of the first battle, you know, in between street kids. Mm-hmm. You know, la-di-da-di? Yeah, I know it. All right, let's hear it. Go ahead. You know, it'd be that kind of dynamic. And that's where, you know, that's where I remember the Roxanne Shanté, the real Roxanne song, was probably the first I learned with the Fat Boys. But then I think with, you know, interacting with other kids, Lottie Dottie was the first like street kind of song that everybody wanted to know by heart. And then it was, you know, we were 13. So at the end, there's some couple of lyrics that are a little, you know, for 13-year-olds, a little funny.
Right. yep.
You know, so I was trying to figure out, what does that mean? What does he mean by that? What does he mean by that? And just asking questions. So that's why I say La-Di-Da-Di was the first page, you know, and then it really made me lose my French accent, you know, which I knew I still have in some, when you hear me talk in certain moments after a while, but it was just the fact that they made fun of me constantly, you know. So rap and learning the raps helped me kind of lose that. So other kids would meet me not like, oh, he's French. You know, funny accent you have.
Was this when, I mean, you come to New York and you kind of, this is kind of the icebreaker, so to say. But when you went back to France, was this, what was this, I guess, you know, the state of, I guess, hip hop culture in France at the time, in terms of like, could you share this with your friends, you know, Adidati, or did you really have to keep it to yourself?
Oh yeah. I mean, when I got to France, that was, I mean, I was going back, you know, some summer time and things like that, but nothing really had picked up yet. And it was when I went back, I graduated high school. I went to the LaGuardia High School up in New York, the Fame School.
Right.
And then I graduated that and I went back to France. And that's when I discovered hip hop through other friends. And it was really just starting. So the rap part, the breakdance part had started already for like almost 10 years by then. And DJing was big, but the rap part was very, 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 at the dinosaur, you know, stages. It was very basic. And there wasn't that many groups. So it was, to me, it was exciting because you were kind of part of the scene as it was just, you know, flourishing. So yeah. That was really cool. And to come and speak perfect English with these French kids who not many could, you know, recite a song, I did feel like a little special, I have to say. You know, like, yeah, I know what he's saying. And kids would come up to me and friends and, Joe, can you tell me, what does he mean by that? What does he say? You know, I don't understand. So it was cool to have that. Definitely.
Were you, in early Cypress Hill days, you know, DJ Muggs, who was from, you know, from New York, used to like, you know, fly back and forth from New York to Cali and bring all these like East Coast, you know, hip hop, and share with, the guys in Cypress Hill. And, you know, that really helped in terms of expanding their music. Was that something similar to what you would be able to do in terms of, you know, getting all the tapes in New York and then flying back to France and like, being like,
for sure, man, that was the kind of vibe, because they didn't have the tapes, you know, or we didn't have CDs yet. We had vinyl, but they would have only a certain amount of pieces, you know, units available. And some of them, you know, depending on the artist, they might go fast. So yeah, the first, second, third week, you'd have to, you know, if you were, you know, a fan of a specific artist and you lived in Paris, you would have to like buy the record.
Okay. You know?
And that's in Paris, because then you have all the cities like Lyon and Marseille, which had, you know, a big hip hop scene, but early on they didn't have records, record stores. So they have to go to Paris to get the records. So yeah, I did bring a lot of stuff. I remember one specific tape that I brought that like blew everybody's mind was the soundtrack for Colors with Ice-T.
That's dope. Nice.
I remember that, like, these graffiti writers was like, yo, what the fuck is this? Yo, what are you playing? I'm like, you never heard of Ice-T? He's like, Ice-T, who's that? And I remember that vibe, you know, for how that song starts with da 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 da, that old piano thing, mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, suspenseful, and then, you know, then I see colors. They were like, oh shit, this is crazy right here. I remember this, like, that moment.
I was reading an interview with you, and you talked about how you kind of discovered hip hop with your mother. Mm-hmm. And I'm just imagining, like, and you talked about Slick Rick earlier, and I remember, like, one of the first tapes I knew front to back and back to front was obviously Slick Rick's debut album, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick, right? And then I think of the first song on that album, which is Treated Like a Prostitute.
Right.
And I can't imagine saying that loud anyway as like an 11 or 12 year old, but also sharing that, you know, that experience with my mother. Can you kind of talk about, discovering hip hop with your mother and how important that was to you to be able to discover with her?
Well, I mean, you know, just to give it a bit of just a setting, she was a photographer for, I guess, 50 years, traveled the world, but mainly three poles were Rio, Paris, New York. So she's always into, like, music heavy, from blues to jazz and then to some soul records. But then she jumped to The Last Poets. She was big on that. Mm. And when she heard hip hop, she was like, wow. This is the continuation of The Last Poets. She was never big on Gil Scott-Heron. Mm-hmm. She recognized his work, but she wasn't a big fan of his work. She was more of a fan of The Last Poets. That was really her shit. Like, we have those records. And we actually went to see them various times live. I was 5 years old when we saw them in 76 in Paris, they played.
Wow.
And she brought him to her school because she taught at a university. And the whole hip hop thing really is because she developed a method of teaching English using hip hop as a tool, but using African American culture as a tool to teach these young people of different backgrounds in France, specifically Paris, specifically in in this university that's very diverse. So she used the hip hop for the story, but also for the rhythm of the language, and to teach these kids, you know, use English, you know, use this, as you call it, weapon, mm-hmm. to teach these kids and interest them. And the whole rapping thing kind of became, like, I was a fan, but I started, like, transcribing lyrics for her classes. So, you know, to make a long story short, when she heard the message in 81, mm-hmm. it was a total, like, oh, what is this? And then the video, I remember it was a CBS, it might have been Cronkite still at the time. This is a new form of music. No. The young kids from the South Bronx. No. I remember that clearly. And that was just the apocalypse. Like, wow, what is this? Oh my God, who are these kids? What? So she did all her research. And then we were in France, and then the first hip hop show came. It was called the New York City Fresh Fest, you know, with Fab Five Freddy leading, Ramel Z rapping. You had Bambaataa, DST on the wheels. You had Dondi and Futura 2000 painting with Lee live, wow. You know, on, like, wooden panels. You'd had Rocksteady Crew breakdancing. And all this was happening simultaneously on the stage.
Right.
If you can imagine this, Tim, because see, what's funny is that in the U.S., this didn't really happen like that. You know, we had, so you'd go to the playground or you go to the block party, you would have the breakdancers and the DJ and maybe the MC. But the way it got introduced to Europe was that it was all happening together. Mm. You know? So right. The European vision, and I always ask myself that question, why Europe is so, like, tight-knit with hip-hop movement being all these disciplines together? Because when we were introduced, we saw all these people together on stage. And we were like, what the fuck is this? You know, a guy rapping, a DJ here, a guy in the back painting. And then they had the double Dutch girls from the McDonald's competition that they were also, you know, there at the same time. So you have all this happening. And that was another apocalypse to me. Like, my mom also, she was like, wow, this is amazing. Look at this. Look at these young kids from the hood creating. This is, wow. This, she just had no words. And there was, what, maybe 200 people there, the show? And that was like the jump off, I would say.
So take me out. You talked about knowing Lottie Dottie and transcribing the lyrics for your mom. But take me out. You're at a show like that, and you see all the elements coming at work. Working together and also working separately. What is the element that you're instantly drawn to, and that you're like, I want to do that. I don't care if it's a career in that or whatever. I want to do that too, as my form of expression.
You know what? I think it was, now that you asked, and that's a very good question, because I never really thought about why that moment may be really the turning point. It's kind of the same feeling. I don't know if you've ever been to Brazil.
No, I want to.
When you go to Brazil, let me know, and I'll link you up with a couple samba schools to go visit.
Oh, dope. Nice.
Because it's that impact, that sound, that sonic impact that, you walk in this, what you call the quadra, which is this, gymnasium where they rehearse. And when the drum, the percussion starts up, your heart just kind of stops. Like, oh! And it's that feeling I remember having when the sound came up and you heard this dude, what is he doing with his hands on this turntable? Mm. What is he doing? And you hear, duff, duff, and a huge beat would come in, and then this guy's just rapping over it. You're like, wow, it's just the sonic impact, I think, was, because, I'm originally, my musical introduction is really drums. That's where I start. I start as a drummer and playing on records as a young kid, going to the turntable and playing on Bob Dylan and Bob Marley and, The Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and people like that. So, I was already into sound, kind of, you would say, as a young kid, because my parents played a lot of music. So I think when we were in this, and this happened in like a circus dome, it was a dome event over, I think, a couple nights. And the sound, the impact was just like, oh, shit. So I think later it still carried on and carried over and said, you want to do this.
So, you look at who have you worked with, and you're telling your story. And so how do you go from someone born in Paris and to living in New York, but then also to becoming connected and working with, such great legends as Daddy-O from Daddy-O, Sadat X, Everlast. How did those connections come to be? Did you seek them out? Did they seek you out? Was it kind of like, a bucket list type thing for you?
Well, I actually had some of it happen. The Daddy-O connection happened when in 1990, my mom and I set out to write a book that we call Freestyle. And the reason why she was really the one who was spearheading this is that at the university where she was teaching, there was another person who was interested in hip hop history and what was happening. So this person, another professor, had also a lot of power at the school, and he kind of instigated and learned what hip hop was and kind of tried to tell people that he was the one who brought it to the school. And that really pissed her off, because she had been working many, many years on this teaching method and using the culture, that she felt that, this guy was trying to I don't know how the word would be, but he was just trying to take it over. She wasn't happy about that. So she wanted the recognition. She said, and she had started, interestingly enough, doing interviews for her classes that she would play for her students. So she already had Curtis Blow. She already had Grandmaster Flash. She had The Last Poets. Wow. She had DST, and she would catch these people when they would come to Paris at shows at different events. So, and there was that whole hip hop event that she got invited to because of the sponsors was like a, kind of a source or hiphop.com kind of, entity. So she was linked to them, blah, 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 did those interviews. And then she said to me, she's like, Sebastian, I got 4 or 5 interviews. Why don't we do a book? Because, right now the kids are complaining, the young hip hop kids are complaining that it's too much analysis because, you know, in France, people like to analyze and talk a lot. But, you know, a lot of times they don't let the people who make the music talk. Mm. So we said, you know what? Why don't we do a book and we interview the people, the actors, and let them speak about what they're doing. So that's really what we set out, which is a book of interviews. And in, I guess, must have been 91, you know, I was doing a lot of back and forth at the time doing interviews in New York, and a lot of, you know, people helping me out. And I have to shout out Dream Hampton, who really, really helped out. You know, she linked me up with so many different people that led to other people. And one of those people was Daddy-O. And Daddy-O, you know, when we interviewed, and I know you talked to him, man, he tell you got a half hour, and then 4 hours later, you're still talking.
Yeah.
Because Daddy-O got stories, you know.
Yeah.
And even back then, you know, this is 91, so it's not like Stetson Song is going on for 30 years.
No? Right, right, right.
They've been going on for like maybe 10 years, maybe even a little less.
Right.
So, you know, he was at a studio, which is near where I live now in Fort Greene, what he called Bed-Stuy still at the time. And it was called Okie Doke Studios, and his manager was his brother, Kedar, you know, Massenburg. So I remember going to interview Daddy-O, and then we ended up talking for like 4 hours about all kinds of stuff. It wasn't just an interview anymore. It was just like talking about life and politics. And he was curious about Europe because, you know, he was one of the first American hip hop producers, artists to work with a European group. You know, he produced that duet called The Cookie Crew. And the Cookie Crew was signed to Polygram UK. So I remember that because I talked to him about that. And he was like, you know the Cookie Crew? How do you know them? I was like, oh, I'm from France originally. He's like, word up, Bob. So, you know, he was interested in the global aspect of the hip hop thing. You know, him and Chuck are like big on that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked, and at the end, I was like, Daddy-O, do you mind? You know, I produce, like, I just started a couple years ago, but I got a couple tracks. I'd love to play for you. He's like, hell yeah. He's like, let's go in the studio. So we're in the studio, play a tape. And he's bopping his head, and I'm like, oh, already like kind of trembling. He's bopping his head, like, oh, shit. And he turns around, he's like, you did this? I was like, yeah. He's like, this shit is dope, man. He's like, why don't you come and see me when you come back to the U.S.? I was like, where? He's like, yeah, just come see me. You probably have done more. I want to hear more. I was like, where? He's like, yeah, come see me. So the following year, I started college up at Purchase University up in White Plains.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't have to tell me twice to call, especially a legend like that, one of my favorite rappers at the time. You know, call me? Hell yeah, I'm going to call you. So that's what I did. And we actually, you know, I was working with I had a music partner at the time, my man Lavive, Lavive, and we signed with Daddy-O's production company. You know, we were two white kids. You know, it's like at the time Fort Greene was very rough, so you can imagine these two white French kids walking into that studio. You know, you cross paths with Big, you cross paths with Junior Mafia Cats. You cross paths with, at the time, his brother Kedar was managing Freestyle Fellowship. And they were I remember we got to work on the track with Freestyle Fellowship. We had no idea who they were. But we heard this shit and we were like, wow, these guys are way advanced in what they're doing.
I imagine it was probably helpful you didn't know who they were. I mean, in terms of how you approach a working session, is it helpful to know who people are or not know?
I know. Actually, at the time, we really didn't care.
Yeah.
You're so eager to work with whoever. And then you had these rappers from the West Coast, you know, cool dudes, but a total different I would say Space is the Place, Sun Ra type hip hop, but just super creative.
So going into that like first studio session with Daddy-O, I mean, what were your, did you have expectations, or did you not, you know, were you just like, we're just going to go in and, you know, just complete something? I mean,
did you? No expectations. Yeah. Super like a child in a candy store. Mm. You know, like, okay, I'm going into a session with Daddy O from Sets of Sonic. All right, let's put that in perspective. Okay. Because, you know, I'm 21 years old. You know, I just turned 20 and I just started college and I just got signed to a major production company and with a chance to work with some serious people. Mm. So I'm, you know, to me, that's crazy.
Right.
It's like a dream come true. You're like, wow, okay, I came to the US and this is happening. Wow. Right. It's like a whole other ball game than what I was doing in France. Like, this is like life changing kind of shit. You know?
Right.
So, so from there, you know, Daddy O was like really the introduction. And then the whole college thing, you know, went down. So I worked as a, you know, that night also did help work relationship was like, I was, you know, was a programming director for events at this school for like 2-3 years. And I was also a, you know, college radio director, you know, for the station director for urban music. So I was developing relationships with labels as far as like being, you know, the radio guy, but also since I was booking, I was building relationships with managers and agents. So when it came, for example, in 1994, we invited KRS to the college. And since I had interviewed Chris and my mom had invited him to her school, to her university in Paris back in 91, we already had established those relationships, you know, with his manager and with Chris himself. So he kind of knew who we were. So when I called for college, oh, Chris, blah, blah, for a show, you know, he did a show for half price of what he would charge, or a third of the price, because we were a smaller school. And also he knew who I was, you know. So that was kind of a highlight because I was 23 years old and the show happened on the night of my birthday. I made it happen that way.
That's awesome.
It really worked out. And the crazy shit was that KRS said my name in his freestyle.
Wow.
So that was just like, you know, another moment of pure candy store. Like, oh, yo, you heard that? You heard? Yo, KRS said my name in the freestyle. You heard it, right?
Right. Like, who was recording that? Who had that tape? Come on.
Exactly. So that helped me build. And then finish college, I got an internship at Def Jam with Dante Ross.
Wow, nice.
And shout to my man Dagan who put me on. And that situation really opened the doors to, because Dante at the time was managing Sadat, who was signed to Loud. So I got to know Sadat. I booked Sadat a couple gigs and we did a record with him, with Get Open. And then that led, you know, we build rapport and we did a few other sessions, you know, after that with Sadat. And then the Everlast situation also came from there because Everlast, you know, Dante comes to me one day, this is might be early 97 at the office and is like, Sibba, you got some beats? I'm like, yeah, always. It's like, you want to submit some stuff for Everlast from House of Pain? I'm like, looking at him, do I want to? Like, hell yeah. Everlast, House of Pain, yeah. He's like, you know, he's doing this record, but it's independent. I mean, it's a solo record. He's no longer with House of Pain, you know, but I'm going to executive produce the record and I'd love for you to submit some stuff. So I was like, am I one of the first ones you're asking? He's like, yeah. I was like, wow, that's an honor, bro.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It was like when you're looking, you know, you're at the A&R office where on the wall you have tapes from Primo, from Q-Tip, from Law Finesse, from Pete Rock, you name them. And one of the hottest tapes, you know, as a side note, was Showbiz. Showbiz Beats 96 are just bananas. I mean, I really say it. Out of all the ones I named, he had the top tape. I mean, a lot of these, back then, these producers, they didn't put everything on the tapes because they were worried that somebody would jack it or have the idea, or it was so, as you know, it was really, it wasn't cutthroat, but you were worried about who would use your sample. So I remember that, and then I submitted some tracks, and then Dante called me up one day, or I remember exactly how it went down. It was like, Zibba, Everlast likes some of your shit. Like, we're going to go to the studio and demo some of this stuff. So I was, again, that's another, as I call it, candy store moment. Wow, all right, damn, we get to work with Everlast. House of Pain, oh shit.
Right.
And what's funny is that in my book, Freestyle, he got interviewed, but that's the only interview that me and my mom did not do.
Oh, interesting.
So when I talked to him about it, it was like a friend who had done it for that, because we weren't available that day, so someone else went to do it. And I remember, saying, you remember this interview? He's like, man, let me tell you something. That a lot of that era is a total blur. We drank so much. We took so much drugs. We barely slept. We did shows. We did this, that. A lot of this stuff is a blur. So that, you know, that situation, you know, Everlast came around, and that was like, you know, what probably my claim to fame moment, because, you know, that I had no expectations on that record. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew it was House of Pain, Everlast. So I was like, there's a chance that this could do big numbers. But again, you know, he was solo. He didn't really know what he was doing, because, you know, originally, a lot of people don't know this about that record, the Whitey Ford Sings the Blues, but it was supposed to be like a Puff Daddy type record. Because at the time, if you remember, the production styles were like, you were jacking 80s songs, putting a beat on it, you know, and then put a little chorus on it, and then here's your song, right?
Right, right.
So I remember, and we talked about Everlast, about releasing this, because I still have the tape of it, the DAT, is that the first song he recorded was Ends. And Ends, the song, was on a Eurythmics sample, Here Comes the Rain Again, a track I did. So this track was that, you know, so, and it had D.V. Elliott's Christ on it, singing the hook, singing the Houdini hook. Ends, how many others have them? I want my ends. And then the turning point was one day, Dante calls me. This, like, he had recorded two songs, maybe two songs in the album, right? Dante calls me like, "Yo, Sibba, come to the studio," or yeah, something like that. He was, "Come to the studio," and I get to the studio, and he's like, "Sibba, listen to this," and Everlast pops out What It's Like, him playing guitar a cappella. I was like on my ass, like, "What? You sing like this?" He was like, "Yeah, man, been a minute, but I just haven't sung out, you know, out to people." I was like, "Yo, that's fucking hot." So Dante looks at me, he's like, "Sibba, I think we're going to change direction on the record." But it became this kind of folky, hip-hop, right, rock, you know, record. But they still kept one of my tracks, Painkillers, which was to him, you know, very important record, because that's what he went through right before he, you know, while he was recording, when they were mastering, he had a heart attack. And right, then he had his, you know, this motorcycle accident where he was on painkillers. And the song he wrote was kind of one of the days when he, you know, hallucinating while, you know, on the effects of the painkiller itself. Right. So that's, you know, I guess I would say I got lucky that they kept that track and became part of that triple platinum record, you know, and I'm thankful. Up to today, you know, always thankful. Back to the five seasons, Mr. Ford. Your usual room is ready and waiting. Let me take your luggage. If you need anything while you're staying, just let me know. Good looking out. I hop out my car, step into the lobby. Everybody's on the floor. It's a motherfucking robbery. This shit's in progress. I can feel the stress. I want to silently to God how I get in this mess. They tell me to freeze and get down on my knees between my jewels and my cash.
Sib, you know, I hear you talking, and I want to And I think about the record "Love" off of the Get Open album, Front and Center, mm-hmm. and it's a track that, you know, essentially what the title is, it's about like doing what you love no matter what the noise might be from the crowd that is trying to take over your creative space, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are and you obviously speak from this, you know, from someone who loves what they do and has, you know, created incredible music with incredible people. For you, what has been the advantages and even the disadvantages of for an artist, for you, for yourself, of creating something purely out of love? I mean, has there ever been times where maybe, you know, you love something so much that there was you just kind of you had the blinders on and people were trying to tell you something and you just didn't listen?
You could say that. You know, I feel sometimes that I look back and I say, at the time, if I, you know, was more, it wasn't even a question about loving what you do, but more like a business minded, like people love what they do, but then they step back and say, okay, how am I going to monetize this, what I love, into, you know, and I think back then I was very young at the way I looked at things. And I mean, you know, I'm not a business minded guy to start. You know, my family's not business minded people. They're not entrepreneurs or, you know, in a way where they invest money into something. They more invest their creatives into something, you know, like that equal out to monetize. So to me, it was like, the purity of what I, you know, my passion of making hip hop kind of like blinded me to not focusing more on the entrepreneurial aspect of things, where, you know, some people were like, damn, man, you should have shot the shit out of that, you know, when you did that Everlast record and got all these other placements. I mean, shit was happening, but I explained to people, for example, that record, the problem for me was that what blew up was the rock songs. So his rock crowd really, you know, gather around him. His hip hop people liked it, but some people got, you know, got turned off by it because it wasn't jump around. It wasn't, you know, boom, shalak, lock, boom anymore, right? So there's those kids who wanted that. So, you know, to me, that's the kind of thing, but it's never, I was thinking the only thing that may have stopped me from, you know, really doing what I love and that is just really the business, you know, of like having to refocus and maybe kind of change what you're creating so you please more people, you know, that kind of vibe.
Right.
Like as a producer, oh, I need to find that formula so, you know, I can bring these checks. And then, because, you know, that's what everyone thinks. And like, oh, and then I'll do a project that I really want to do. You know, there's some people think that way, but then, you know, they get into the whole formula thing, and if it works out, they're gonna like work that. You know, I think of Wyclef. Once he found that formula, he's like, "Man, I'm running with this till the end."
Right. Sure.
You know.
you've worked with obviously like not just English speaking artists, but also French speaking artists and other artists. Mm-hmm. What is? And this is not a question that's supposed to be English artists versus French artists. But what do you feel like an English speaking artist kind of brings into a studio that you kind of wished a French speaking artist brought into the studio? And then what do you think a French speaking artist brings into a studio that you kind of wished an English speaking artist brought into the studio?
Good question. What I think, you know, if you talk about hip hop, I think what I saw early on was, I guess maybe because it was early on, but this the US hip hop mentality or the US artist mentality is much more, there's a lot more confidence, I would say. And there's also, you know, you deal with a lot of people that have a lot more background musically speaking, because see, the thing problem is, I would say it's a problem, but thing in France, a lot of young people, our generation, may not have had, you know, musical upbringing like a person, you know, for example, like a young African-American man or woman living in Alabama is going to hear some blues, going to hear some jazz, they're going to hear some funk. And then if they hear Mystical, if they hear Master P or you know, they're going to hear, they might hear that drumline vibe, right, you know, happening. So it's related, but we don't have that in France. So you may have even an African, you know, a young man or young woman from African descent, or even if she's from Guadeloupe, which is like the main, you know, colonies, you know, of people of, you know, African descent.
Right.
Those kids did not have that kind. Some of them may have had that upbringing, but musically speaking, they did not listen to the same thing. So the way they approach music, you know, I think is a whole other way, you know, especially hip hop. I mean, what's great for hip hop with hip hop, what I think it did to the whole world aside from the US, is it educated young people to music they never listened to before. You know, from all the people digging, you know, so of course you listen to that, to all these records that you may, obscure records that you may never, you know, think of touching before because you're trying to find a sample. So, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But so I think that's what, you know, the US is just that confidence, and it's also that knowledge and background and reference to stuff that, you know, when you're having a session, or, oh, you know, and so-and-so and that song, you know, when they're singing, you know, that part, blah, 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 when she's doing that, and you know, that little, and that person's like, yeah, yeah, I know what you say. Oh, yeah, okay, you want that? Yeah, all right, cool. And then you go back in, boom.
Man.
You won't have those references in France. But what you may have, you know, is, I don't know, it's a different approach in the studio in France. Is less, it's more clinical, you know, like with recording engineers and things like that. I felt, you know, and I hope they don't read this and take this the wrong way, but sometimes felt a little more stiff. Because also engineers, you know, in France, probably not now because things have changed and a lot of young people have gotten to the game, but back in the late 80s, early 90s, engineers like looked at hip hop artists as like, you know, like losers. Like, oh, you guys are not musicians, or you guys are the guys that are sampling, stealing stuff from people. And, you know, and also not being, a lot of them not being, you know, how would you say, collaborative in a session. You know, kind of like hating on the situation, like, oh, damn, I got to do this session now with these losers, like, get this over with.
Yeah, trying to get it over with. Is the hour up yet type thing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, early on, when they didn't see, you know, the dollars or the euros, now that they see the euros, like, they'll do the sessions, no problem.
Right.
You know, because it is, I mean, it is, what, 20% market share, if not more, in France. And that's huge. You know, it's still the number one music aside from just, you know, French chanson, as they call it. You know, it's like, I mean, it's the second after maybe UK. I mean, not even, because UK doesn't produce that much of their own hip hop. It's France is number one after the US, you know, still as a market.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, a quote unquote American, you know, music session, with, you know, talking about different genres of music. And then you think about your group Get Open, and, you know, you three are like from these, have seems like very diverse musical backgrounds and musical families. Can you take us into just, you know, even if you want to pick a song that you guys created and kind of take us into a creative session briefly of like the beats coming together and the music coming together and the lyrics coming together, and kind of how does that work with you guys?
Well, just let's take this one song, which actually I'm going to repost today because the George Floyd trial started yesterday.
Right.
This song that was actually the first single we called Tale of the Tape.
Mm-hmm.
And Tale of the Tape came around that we wrote, I think we wrote our verses separately. Because that's what happens, like we have weekly sessions, we'll play beats, and we'll choose some instrumentals we like, and then we'll have a, I won't say silent moment, but we'll just play the track over again, and then see what we come up with within a short amount of time.
The look is worth a million. Them only one destruction total.
And if something creative, you know, comes up, then we'll build on that. So I think at the moment we all started writing verses, and Vaughn Meister is actually the guy in the group that's, I would say, probably, and to me, and you know, I wish he would do more of this work, but one of the best chorus writers, hook writers that I know. So I mean, he gets inspired, he can be so quick with it. And I don't remember how he just, because what he does, and you know, I know a lot of other rappers do this as well, is you kind of hum something and you have the rhythm. So you go, you know, kind of like you're doing a percussive pattern in your head that you think will work with what's happening, you know, musically and rhythmically with the song. So he was kind of humming some, and then, and he's from Caribbean. You know, his background, you know, is a lot of reggae, a lot of dancehall, soca, roots, ska stuff. And then he was just humming. And then he's like, oh, I got it, tailor the tape. Just all of a sudden, I'm like, how'd you come up with that? He's like, oh, well, you know, tailor the tape never lies. You know, that's a term for boxing, but the tape in our situation is the video. That doesn't lie, you know, it's there, it's recorded, it's boom, it's ingrained in history. And it went from there. And then, you know, I grew up in New York, 13, 14, in 84, 85, and the guy on, you know, a big sports fan, and the guy on TV that my father loved to watch at the news with Channel 2 News was Warner Wolf.
Yeah, Warner Wolf Sports.
There you go. You see, so you're a true Yorker. You know the deal. If you know Warner Wolf.
Let's go to the video tape.
There you go. So we're looking at each other, and I said, I think it was all me or some, or maybe Campbell said, we need to use Warner Wolf. So we went in, you know, and we got a little snippet where he said, let's go to the videotape. And so, you know, it just all worked out after that, you know, and just of each person finishing out their rhymes. But, you know, it's kind of the process that usually happens, how, you know, how we work. We rarely come up with stuff. We write on our own, but hooks and concepts usually happen when we're together. Unlike maybe some other groups that find stuff on their own, and then when they come back, like, oh, I got this idea, or give somebody a call or email, whatever. You
know? I mean, do you feel that, you know, obviously, a teletape is, like you said, commentary on Floyd and obviously the social injustices and police brutality. Do you feel hip hop is moving kind of back towards that moment of speaking, being more quote unquote political, or speaking out more against social injustices? Or do you think they kind of, we've lost that in a way and we should get back to it?
Well, I think it's the second part of your answer, where I think is there was a, I had a sense that we may have had a chance for it to really pick up, because, you know, if P came back with a record that people were listening to, you know, finally, after not listening, really paying attention to P for a long time, then you have, you know, the Baby had his song with Roddy Ricch, then you would have, you know, a couple other tunes. There's that Toby Cat. I can't pronounce his last name. But so there were some records that when we came out, because we never planned for our record to come out and to be called front and center, to come out last year. We didn't really have plans of when we put out a record. It's the filmmaker, the guy who did the Where I'm From video, Pascal Tissot, who called me, because we had shot that video a year before, the summer before. And he's like, oh, what are you going to do with the video? When are you coming out with your record? So I was like, oh, I'm not sure yet. He's like, well, you know, it's getting So it's going to be come close to a year, in a couple of months. You guys might want to think of putting it out. So yeah, but we don't have a record out yet. We don't have a concept. So that's when I sat back and said, maybe it's a good time because we have so many political records, songs on the album. I'm like, this is the time. And, we're going through Trump. We're going through this. We're going through that. Why not? Let's put this out. I mean, it's COVID. It may be not the most ideal time, but people are at home. People are at home listening, watching. So maybe it is a good time. And that's when we decided to move forward with it. And then all this happened, these people had these records and wow, okay.
Steve, I want to step back a little bit because, you're not just obviously you do a lot of, writer, producer, but you also, I think what's important is you helped curate this exhibit in France in 2017-2018, which is featured photographs from the golden age of, and artifacts from the golden age of hip hop. I know this is, I'll probably ask all the time, but why that era for you? But two, and you did touch on it, so, if you could expand a little bit, but two, who do you think, at first, and, obviously it's changed with more French hip hop artists coming out, but who were those American artists or artists that you think had maybe the biggest impact on, if people of your generation or maybe a little younger as well in France?
I'd say the artists who had the most impact, I would say hip hop wise, is Public Enemy. Public Enemy impact towards that early 90s generation is unequaled in France. For various reasons, because they came and played a small club, tiny club, and with, I forgot, I think Terminator X couldn't come, so Red Alert came as their DJ.
It's not a bad replacement.
I know, right? And they played a tiny club, and there's some photos in the exhibit that we had of that show. We actually had the poster as well of that show at the exhibit. And so that's the artist I would say. Run DMC had major impact, but Public Enemy, I think, takes it for various reasons. What a lot of people don't know is that, I don't know in other countries, but in France, the first big, when right after Takes a Nation, well, I think it was a Fear of Black Planet came out, it's 91. When they came to France, they played like a major arena of 5,000 people. And no rap group had ever played that sized arena in France, right? And I remember, and I had also this in the exhibit, the headline of how would you compare it? It wouldn't be Wall Street Journal because they're now Bezos kind of owns it. But maybe at the time when they were, maybe like a New York Post, more right wing, would have like a headline, like a Public Enemy at Madison Square Garden. And here comes the racists are playing Madison Square Garden tonight. Be careful.
Oh, right.
White people, right. Be careful. Imagine that kind of headline? Yeah,
that's amazing.
I was like, what? And this is like headline of Figaro newspaper, which is not extreme right wing, but right wing conservative. I was like, everybody was shocked. Like, what? Public Enemy is getting front line? Headline? Like, what? So, of course, everybody wanted to go see who Public Enemy was. Because your media, could create that kind of buzz. And, then they played and they toured Europe. They did a lot of shows in France, but their impact was very, and I think it's still felt, although a lot of kids don't know, but a lot of that, influenced a lot of kids to write meaningful songs, So the whole 90s hip hop in France is very, there's a lot of content, there's very little bling bling, very little ego tripping. You had to be really nice to get over ego tripping in France at the time.
See, but you talked to, You did talk about a language, right? In terms of you were able to go back and, you know, translate the lyrics, right, for people. But obviously, you can't do that for everyone in France, right?
Right.
Can you tell me about what, in terms of Public Enemy, for example, like what besides knowing what the lyrics are, what is it that also stands out to the youth about them? And I asked that because I remember years ago I had the opportunity. I was in Japan. I had the opportunity to see Prophets of Rage perform, and you know, incredible show. And a lot of people have showed up, but I imagine there is this lost in translation, right?
Right.
So what is it about, if you take away the meaning behind the lyrics, what is it about someone like Public Enemy that would stand out to?
Well, see, it's actually a question that you ask brings an answer that I always want to talk about. And it's the underrated Bomb Squad. The Bomb Squad to me is, with Molly Mall and Primo and RZA, probably the most prolific, and Organized Noise, excuse me, the most prolific production crew ever assembled. Because when you listen to what's happening musically, as my mom called it, the soundtrack behind Chuck D is just unequaled, unparalleled, as far as like the urban warfare that's happening in that music. And the best example, and that was my mom, probably her favorite song, though she loved 911 as a joke. She was a Terror Dome fan. Terror Dome would just like get us so excited, and she would just sing that shit out. Like, I got so much. You hear, you know, a 65-year-old woman singing Chuck D lyrics and being excited about it. You know, I got so much trouble. Oh, oh, oh. I'm like, Mom, what's up? She's like, oh, I want to play P. You know, it kind of became her anthem song to when people, you know, next door or neighbors make noise. She would just turn the Terror Dome on, and that would just shut everybody up. Because that's a pretty, you know, heavy, I won't say violent is not the word. It's an aggressive song. But, I mean, it's that aggression, you know, that you, and that's really what people felt with Public Enemies musically. And then Chuck and Flav going back and forth, and that, you know, yin and yang thing happening on stage with the S1s and Griff. Just that energy was just, even if you didn't understand what they said, you know, rhythmically, if you heard that, he had Chuck rapping, you know, who, and back then Chuck was doing triplets, you know, like these kids are doing triplets in their trap rapping. You know, he's solo on the rope, but they beat it, and he really, you know, so there's that factor really, I think, you know, touched people, was the music, you know, behind that, you know, forget the James Brown samples, because a lot of people didn't even hear the James Brown samples until they started analyzing what was there, because there was so much going on, you know? So yeah, Public Enemy, major impact. But also to answer your question, because you're asking, you know, why at that exhibit, the Golden Era was chosen. It was chosen because, well, first of all, that's what the museum's theme was. They wanted to, the director of the museum wanted to touch upon the early stages of hip hop and how it began, and historically, and, you know, and also I would say, as far as urbanism is concerned, how it came about in the city, you know, and why the Bronx became the Bronx, because of the Cross Bronx Expressway and construction, which led to African American Latino being like, you know, caged in an area and kids not having nothing to do. So one of them, you know, he come from Jamaica. He had the idea of putting these two turntables together and put some music on. All right. That kind of, you know, that really, that fascinated the director of the museum. So, you know, he came to me through a common friend, because he knew I'd written his book, Freestyle. So he's like, oh, you probably have a good foot in both countries, and that's what I need. I need somebody who's equal in France as in the U.S., who has, you know, the connection and the history with both worlds. So that's how that came about. And, you know, having done this book, that really helped, because a lot of the old, you know, old friends like Henry Chalfant and people like that, you know, automatically said, "Sebastian, for you, Sibba? Come on, man. Of course." You know, then that led to Joe Conzo and Martha Cooper, to, you know, Ricky Powell. And then, you know, Prince Paul, for example, lending a couple pieces. You know, Jeanette Beckman, Jonathan Mannion, Jamel Shabazz. You know, a lot of the Joe Conzo, a lot of the top photographers, the hip-hop photographers, you know, participated. So that was a blessing. You know, it was a whole other world for me, but a lot of fun, because I got to educate a lot of people about hip-hop and history of it and where it came from and how it developed, that had no idea, you know. People have no clue. I mean, I don't think people in the U.S., a lot of people in the U.S. also sometimes, if you don't dig, don't know. But in France, they have no idea. And they don't search it out either.
Right. Sina, I have two more questions.
Yep.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, thank you, man. Appreciate talking to you.
If there was... I'll let you pick your poison on this one. If there was a record, or even maybe a sample that was used in a record that you could have been either, you wish you did, or could have been a fly on the wall in the studio while it was being made, do you have a record in mind, or just because of like the sample that the person used in it that kind of blew you out of your, you know, blew you away?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. If it was, I mean, I'll try to give two answers, because a sample, I mean, I would have loved to be, as far as samples, in a Bob James session, just to hear, you know, that process. Although, and no knock on not Bob James, but, you know, when I listen to his records, I don't really listen to Bob James records. To me, it's elevated music. You know, it's that smooth jazz. And when it was made for that. I don't think he thought about, hey, these hip hop kids going to sample me in 30 years, right? So there's that. But as far as favorite artist, if I could have been in the Stevie Wonder sessions for Songs in the Key of Life, Fly on the Wall, I would have been there. I would be a happy man. That's my favorite artist.
A few years ago, I got to interview Kwame, and he talked about being like a 5-year-old kid, and his aunt and mom like brought him to a Stevie Wonder show.
Yeah.
And he like for a minute stopped, looked around, it's like, oh, I get it. Like how amazing, you know, how amazing they were. There he was. And my final question is going back to your group. If you take the current album and kind of look at the tracks and the record and what you guys created, is there a kind of your moment that's like, oh, wow, I can't believe we made that, or I can't believe that record came together? Maybe one particular record on this track, on this album?
Yeah, the song that we did with the French group, I Am, these are old friends. But we never got to collab, because when our group was kind of like started to take off a little bit, we buzzing in like 97, they just, and I'd known them for like 6 years from being on like one of the big TV shows in France. Actually, my mom was invited to that show, and it's tough to compare, but you know, in France we have talk shows in prime time at 8 p.m., you know, the kind of variety shows, as they call them. If you look at Latino TV, you see a lot of that on Saturday nights, you know, Sabado Gigante. So, you know, they have all kinds of music. And so they had a show like that in France that kind of introduced hip hop to the masses, I would say. And that was in 91. And MC Solar was on that show. The group I Am was on that show. But a few other groups. And that introduced hip hop to the French masses. And my mom and I were invited you know, to that show. And me and my homie, we got to rap a little bit a cappella live on TV with, you know, you had what, 20 million people watching. So we met that group IM then. So we always kept in touch, you know, and then in 96, they blew up. Like when I say blew up, they sold like a million records. I mean, France, when you sell a million records, like you go diamond. It's almost like if you sold 10 million here, you know? So they were like massive, massive. And we always said, yo, we're going to do a record together. And it was always tough to catch them because they were so busy. So then this record came around. And I said to myself, I was like, you know, I haven't done anything. These guys are probably home, sitting at home, not being able to tour. Maybe you could talk to them. Maybe they'd be down to do this. So I went in and I said, I offered the track. And, you know, these guys are old school guys like us. So, you know, if you talk to a hip hop artist, like a guy like Daddy-O today or Chuck, right? These guys are pretty set in their ways and the way they make records or the way they make music, right? It's funny I say that, but they're just like jazz musicians. I'm heavy into jazz, right? And I play drums, jazz musicians. That's the guys who brought me up. My mom was heavy into that world. So I have a lot of friends and I play with some cats. And old jazz musicians are just like old school hip hop cats. They're just set in their ways. They don't want to, you know, when in the 80s, my mom used to talk to these jazz cats about hip hop. Like, what's that shit music? Music. You know, they were saying that. 10 years later, they're looking at my mom like she's like, you know, a visionary because she saw it. And they're like, you were right, does the mom. You were right. But they were still. It'd be tough to get them to play on a hip hop record. You know what I'm saying? Because of that reluctance. And I feel that hip hop cats today, the older ones, are exactly the same. They're not just going to record on anything and they're not just going to do this. And they have their ways they want to do it. You know, how they go to the studio and their little routine. So with these French dudes, I had to think of that. I can't just approach them like, oh, fellas, get on this track. Yo, here's the track. No. You got to approach it a certain way. Okay, these dudes, they operate this way. And, you know, so it's just this approach that I think, you know, that was important. And also the type of record, because these guys are not going to rap on just any instrumental because Sibba asked them to. You know, and they wanted their friends, so they're going to do me a favor. No, so things don't operate that way, you know, when you create. It's like you got to be, you know, you got to have a green light. It's like, yeah, I like this instrumental, or I like the top of their song. Yeah, I could do this. And that all worked out. And to me, that was an accomplishment because they're a major group. You know, and to get them to record like this on a record on the fly, like kind of fast, you know, with a 2-week kind of deadline, was like, to me, an accomplishment, knowing how busy and, you know, how they could not have the time or, you know, maybe not inspired at the moment. Who knows?
Awesome.
So it's In My Life. That's the song. Actually, it's the next song I'm going to work on visuals about.
So, Sibba Dibba from Get Open. Man, dude, thank you so much for taking the time to...
Thank you, Tim, man. It's been a pleasure to conversate with you, man. Big city making money is the vendetta. My pleasure, live the manifest to the letter. Old era outperforming cause it's made better. Yeah, yo, handcrafted, tailor-made, yo, artisanal. Seasons vets, pay dues, yeah, professional. Satisfaction guaranteed, stay exceptional. Gritty and white tracks, we keep blessing you, impressing you. Been like that since the get now. Well equipped, focused, we ready, set now. Love versus hate the current sentiment. What about climate change, the environment? Stay positive, owe it to hip-hop. Culture much appreciated before it went pop. Before it gained stock, it oversaw rock. On that street block, globally it won't stop.